The couple, whose families were neighbors, had planned to elope and flee to neighboring Iran, but their parents are believed to have approached the Taliban, saying they had not given permission to the children to marry. As a result, militants took the two by force several days ago and tried them before a Taliban court. They were found guilty of immoral acts and sentenced to death. Saraya Sarhadi Nelson, NPR News, Kabul.
North Korea says it'll restart its nuclear reactor and won't attend any more international talks about its nuclear program. North Korean leaders are piqued about a recent condemnation by the UN Security Council. The council reprimanded North Korea for test firing a missile recently, breaking an international agreement. North Korea says the action is hostile. International talks have been going on for well over 5 years. I'm Korva Coleman, NPR News, from Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Kauffman, the foundation of entrepreneurship, committed to growing economies and expanding human welfare. On the web at Kauffman.org.
Today's broadcast is made possible by Carle Foundation Hospital. Carle Foundation Hospital provided more than $80 million in community benefit last year, including almost $10 million in free or discounted care. More information about how Carle embraces its charitable mission is in its annual report at Carle.org. Support for today's programs comes from the Corkscrew Wine Emporium, 203 North Vine, Urbana, with wines, beers, and spirits for the serious collector to the first-time buyer. Wine tastings are held every Saturday from 2 to 6. Information is available at 337-7704 or at thecorkscrew.com.
Good morning. Welcome to hour number two of Focus 580, our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producers for the show, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, Kyle Mabry, is at the controls this morning. A big chunk of the federal budget goes to three programs, Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid. And every year, the costs associated with these programs go up. A lot of people have been arguing for some time that this rate of growth is simply unsustainable. Yet, some of the most common strategies that have been offered to deal with that increasing cost, things like eliminating waste, raising taxes, growing the economy, they just don't seem to be adequate to the task. This morning, in this part of the show, we'll be talking about entitlement programs and their economic impact and about the problem of their growing cost. And we have two guests, one here in the studio with me and one joining us by telephone. Andrew Biggs is resident scholar at the American Enterprise Institute in Washington, D.C. Previously, he was principal deputy commissioner of the Social Security Administration, where he oversaw policy research efforts and also led the agency's participation in the Social Security Trustees Working Group. He also has investigated the trade-offs involved in meeting the projected budgetary shortfalls of Social Security. He also worked in 2005 on Social Security reform in the White House and the National Economic Council, and in 2001 was on the staff of the President's Commission to Strengthen Social Security. He's here with me in the studio. Also joining me here by telephone is Robert Bixby. He's the executive director of the Concord Coalition. It's a nonpartisan, a grassroots organization dedicated to fiscal responsibility. It's been around since 1992. And the two organizations here are involved in something that's called the Fiscal Wake-Up Tour. Groups of people from various kinds of public policy organizations from different points on the political spectrum have now for some time been traveling around the country and doing panel discussions talking about this very issue. And one thing I want to make sure to mention is that one of these events will be happening on the U of I campus today. The sponsor is the Center for Business and Public Policy, and I believe that's within the College of Business. It's happening at the Deloitte Auditorium at 4 o'clock this afternoon. And it is open to anybody who is interested in attending. Our guest here, Andrew Biggs, will be one of the panelists. Also, Diane Rogers, chief economist with the Concord Coalition, and also Dave Sertner, who is director of federal affairs for AARP. So if you're interested in that, you certainly should feel welcome. This is at the Business Instructional Facility. It's at 515 East Gregory on the U of I campus and sponsored again by the Center for Business and Public Policy in the College of Business. So questions here are welcome as we talk. 800-273-9455 is the number here in Champaign-Urbana. We do also have a toll-free line, which means if it would be a long-distance call for you, use that number, and that is 800-222-9455. So at any point here, you have questions, comments, you're certainly welcome to call in. The only thing we ask of people to call in is just people try to be brief so we can get in as many callers as possible, but anybody's welcome to call. And here in studio with me, Andrew Biggs. Thanks very much.
Thanks very much for having me.
And joining us on the telephone is Robert Bixby. Mr. Bixby, hello.
Hi, how are you?
I'm fine, thanks. And yourself?
Not bad.
Good. I want to ask maybe as a general question, because I think, and do set me straight if that's not right, but this whole business of the fiscal wake-up tour, was it the Concord Coalition primarily the organization that got this thing going in the first place?
Well, it has its roots a long time ago, but Concord has taken the lead in organizing it. It also involved the people from the Brookings Institution, the Heritage Foundation, and David Walker when he was Controller General of the United States. But we were the only group with a field organization, and so we've taken the lead in organizing it.
Okay. And this, and as we will talk here, we know that you're involving people from different kinds of organizations, public policy organizations that have different kind of political orientations. So not necessarily that everybody has got on the same page with the solution, but what seems to be the case is that everybody is on the same page that this is a problem and it's something that we've got to address.
Yeah, I mean, that was really the main point of the fiscal wake-up tour and our ongoing message is that liberals and conservatives, Democrats and Republicans can all look at the same numbers and say this is unsustainable. And so we will have different ideas about, the right mix of taxes and spending and debt. But we can all agree that we can't stay on our current course. And I think it's important for people to hear that. I mean, you get people from different points of view agreeing on something.
Yeah. I'll turn here to our guest in the studio. Do you want to just talk numbers for a little bit and talk about, what is it that we really are talking about in terms of how much we're spending, particularly on these big three? Program.
Sure. Social Security makes up around 21% of the total federal budget. So about $1 in every $5 that the government spends goes to this one program alone. Social Security is the largest single spending program in the federal budget. Medicare and Medicaid together, they make up around 22% of total federal spending. So if you put these big three entitlements together, Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid, you're looking at over 40% of the entire federal budget today going to these programs is somewhere over 8% of gross domestic product. 8% of the entire economy goes to these three programs. Now, you can question whether that's the right level of spending on these programs versus other priorities, but the real difficulty comes with projections for the future where these programs are growing at a rate much faster than the growth of the economy or the capacity of the budget to support them. So the quip is that over time, the government becomes simply a pension plan with an army. If you go long enough, there's no room for an army even. That Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid will effectively take over the budget. So that means we have some real decisions to make for the future about what shape we want these programs to be in, how big we want the government to be. And I think that's what the Fiscal Wake-Up Tour is so effective at doing, is getting people from all across the political spectrum, but who are knowledgeable in these issues and are willing to talk about them and discuss some of the tough choices we're facing.
Yeah. Let me turn back to Robert Bixby. Clearly here, the kind of demographic trends that we're talking about, aging of the population, size of the workforce, and projections about how much we'll be spending on these programs in the future, this is something we've known about for some time. And we've talked about it here from time to time. I'm sure people talk about it in Washington all the time. But it seems that somehow, I don't know if it's there isn't sense of urgency about it, or maybe the problem is that we can't seem to agree on exactly what the right solution is. Why is it that we really haven't come to grips with this before now? And still, we're talking about it, but in terms of really dealing with it on a policy level, we're still in the talking stage.
Well, the reason that nothing happens is that there aren't politically attractive options. Politicians, and that's how we got into this mess in the first place, politicians like to talk about cutting taxes and raising spending, And they don't necessarily talk about it in those terms, but they'll talk about increasing benefits or, you know, cutting taxes to grow the economy or whatever. But so those are politically pleasing messages. They're pain. They're painless messages. And you do enough of that, and you end up with a big gap between what you're promising to spend and what you're willing to tax to pay for it. Now, these promises for the entitlement programs are they're embedded in law. That is, Congress doesn't review them on an annual basis, so they're basically they're on autopilot. And in order to change course, they would have to find some way to scale back the promised benefits. That wouldn't mean immediate benefit cuts, but it would mean you know, scaling back the promises in the future, and or biting the bullet and raising taxes to pay for it. And those aren't good campaign messages. And so, you know, on the political campaign trail, people just find ways to procrastinate.
Why don't we talk here just for a moment? We'll pick one and talk about Social Security. That I think that's maybe a good place to start, particularly because, Andrew Biggs, you were involved in that when you were working in government. It seems that certainly the trends we're talking about, we've known about that for some time. We know how many people there are. We know how old they are. We know when they're going to retire. We have some idea about what we're going to be paying out in benefits. We know what the workforce is going to look like that's going to be paying into the system from which we pay the benefits. And that's where the concern about unsustainability comes, where we got a lot more people drawing benefits than we have people who are working and paying into the system. And people have been talking about this for some time. And in fact, President Bush, I think right as he was starting his second term, he said he obviously wanted to make Social Security reform a major issue, and it seemed like that went nowhere in a hurry. What happened there, and why was it that didn't go anywhere?
Well, the full disclosure is I worked at the White House National Economic Council during 2005, so I was involved with the campaign then that President Bush initiated to reform Social Security, and there were a number of reasons why that failed. One is simply the sheer difficulty of the issue. You'll hear many people say today, well, Social Security is not a big problem. It's all health care. It's all Medicare. Fixing Social Security alone is a difficult issue. It would involve significant increases in taxes or significant reductions in future benefits. So even had the cards been played completely right, it would have been a very difficult problem to solve. But there's additional issues that President Bush favored the inclusion of personal accounts as part of Social Security reform, which was something I favored as well because I thought it had some useful purposes. But this was something that was considered to be very offensive to many Democrats who thought that Social Security shouldn't include any sort of market or individual investment. And I think a third point was that many Democrats didn't feel they'd been reached out to, that they didn't feel that their concerns were being taken on board. And so as we reconsider these issues, I think it's very important for both sides to be very diligent in trying to actually listen to people on the other side and realize that we have disagreements about these issues, but we have to come to some sort of solution. So again, that's why something like the Fiscal Wake-Up Tour is so helpful, because it brings to the table people who are willing to talk to each other and people who are willing to listen.
Yeah. Well, it and again, as I think back to and as I understood it, part of what President Bush was talking about was for younger people who were just starting out into their working lives, that the option should be there and that they could take some of the money that under the old system, everything just went into the system and the government took care of it and the government ran it. And then when the day came to draw benefits, the government paid the benefits. And that the idea was that we were going to change the mix. And for younger people who were coming in, we were going to say to them, well, some of that money will be set aside. We can give you some choices, but what we'd like you to see you do is take some of that money and invest that, probably invest it in the stock market, in some kind of approved number of mutual funds, and in a sense sort of split the system so that you have some that you're kind of managing yourself and then some that we're going to still do in the way that we've always done it. Was, in your mind, was that important Or was that a sort of a side issue and maybe ended up being a distraction?
I think at the end of the day, it ended up being a distraction. The idea of personal accounts as part of Social Security, I think it can be important in two ways. One is if we save more today, if we put more money aside today, that can help relieve the burden on future generations from having to pay our benefits. Social Security and the other entitlements are today funded on a pay-as-you-go basis, which means we simply transfer taxes from today's workers and pay them out as benefits to today's retirees. If we can pre-fund some of those benefits by putting aside money today, that helps relieve the burden in the future. The personal accounts could also let low-income people diversify their retirement savings a little bit. But the problem is the accounts themselves didn't do anything to solve the underlying problem. We have more retirees collecting benefits, fewer workers paying into the system, costs are rising. It didn't do anything to address the fundamental solvency issues of the system, and yet it was a very, very controversial policy move. So I think at the end of the day, the controversy over the personal accounts made it more difficult to solve some of the underlying problems of raising taxes, cutting benefits, increasing the retirement age. Those are things that had to be done whether we had personal accounts or whether we don't have personal accounts. Yeah. So I think in retrospect, they did prove to be a bit of a distraction.
Let me turn to Robert Bixby. I'm just interested in your perspective on within the past couple of years, how this whole discussion about what to do about Social Security has gone.
Well, it's very frustrating. You know, I was part of the Clinton effort in 1998. That was the Save Social Security first year, and we had a budget surplus, and people were wondering how, you know, what to do with it. And there was President Clinton decided to have these series of forums on Social Security, and he asked the Concord Coalition and the AARP to organize these forums because he wanted them to be bipartisan, and he wanted them to be to have people like Concord, who would be you know, fiscal conservatives, and AARP, that would be more you know, looking out for the beneficiaries, to work together. And we did, and I was very proud of the way that these came out. David Sertner, who's out there today for the forum, was part of that as well, as he and I were both staff people for the respective organizations. Anyway, It's been very frustrating to me that all the same issues that we dealt with then were dealt with during the Bush years, and they're the same ones that are presenting themselves now, except that we have less time to deal with it. That we've wasted that opportunity when the boomers were still several years away from retirement. And so we've squandered that effort to that opportunity to, you know, phase in some changes that would bring in more revenues or reduce promised benefits. And the longer we wait, the more difficult this is going to become. So I feel like we're just like going through the same thing. If people know what needs to be done. Andrew's laid out the basic options, and everybody in Washington is familiar with them. There are no new tricks here. It's just summoning the political will to do them, which is unlike Medicare, where people really can't figure out how to control health care costs, which is a much more difficult proposition. Social Security is just it's a benefit formula and a level of taxation, and it's a means of trying to reconcile the two. And so it's just the problem is entirely political, and it's very frustrating.
Well, just as Andrew Biggs said, it seems that that the choices are pretty limited to the things that he mentioned that we've been talking about for a long time. Things like, well, either you're going to have to reduce benefits, or you're going to have to raise the retirement age, or you might think about actually increasing the taxes that fund the system, or you might have to do all of those things, a little bit of all of those things, to deal with the problem. Do you, Mr. Bixby, maybe I ask it like this. Well, what's your prescription? What would you personally say we should do?
I would choose the latter, which is probably a little of everything. Mm-hmm. Personally, I think that you have to look at where we are as a matter of rising costs is a problem. One of it is because of the aging population, and the other part of it is because the benefit formula is programmed to generate progressively higher benefits over the years because it's linked to growth in the economy. So I would begin with some combination of raising the eligibility age slowly. You phase it in. It's not like you're going to tell somebody who's 61 that suddenly you can't retire until you're 69 or something like that. It's easy to demagogue this stuff and exaggerate, but you phase in something like that, and change the benefit formula to make it somewhat more progressive. There's a thing called progressive price indexing, which gets very complicated to explain, but basically the bottom third of workers would continue with the same formula, and by the time you get to the top third of workers, they would have a less generous reimbursement on their contributions. And some combination of that would satisfy me. I think politically you're also going to have to raise the cap on the tax, which is now capped at almost $107,000. And people say, well, upper-income people should pay more. So I think that would – I wouldn't eliminate the cap because that leads to all sorts of problems, I think. But I think if you could raise that a little bit, I think that's going to be necessary for a political deal. So you have some combination of new revenues and phased-in benefit cuts, and I think that would work.
Mm-hmm. Well, it would Andrew Biggs, would you sign on to that, or would you sign on to some of that?
There's not much I disagree with substantively with what Bob was saying. I think it's likely when a deal is struck politically, it will look something like that. I guess what I would say is that as we look forward with these programs, we want to reconsider how they're structured and whether they can do in the future what they did in the past. Social Security has always been a universal program, meaning that pays pretty generous benefits even to very high-income people. And in the past, when the demographics were different, I think the system could afford to do that. But going into the future when Social Security costs will be rising, when Medicare, Medicaid costs are rising, the budget is under greater pressure, I think we have to think more carefully about how Social Security is going to go about its purposes. Social Security is described as a social insurance program, and I agree with that it provides insurance against disability, insurance against the death of a family member, and insurance against poverty and retirement. But I think you want to focus more closely on those purposes, scale back benefits for higher earners, paying somebody who earned $100,000 each year of his life, $25,000 a year in retirement. You're not really insuring him against much of anything. What you are insuring, though, is you're going to have to raise his taxes in order to pay those benefits. I would prefer to hold the line on taxes as much as I can because I know those taxes are going to be needed for health care and for other purposes, and simply scale back the benefits for higher earners, increase the retirement age. One little factoid that pops into my head about the retirement age is if you go back to the 1950s, the typical person claiming Social Security benefits for the first time was somewhere over the age of 68. This was at a time when people were working in steel mills and coal mines and factories and farms, when life expectancies were lower and life was tougher, and still they claimed benefits at age 68 or so. Today, the typical person claims benefits at age 62 or 63, even though we're living longer, we're healthier. I'm not saying that there aren't some people who have health problems and can't afford to work longer, but the typical American can't afford to delay retirement by a couple of years. And the third thing I would do is institute a set of universal savings accounts for retirement outside of Social Security that would ensure that everybody has at least something set aside for retirement. If everybody saved as they should for retirement, Social Security's job would be so much easier because it could focus on helping out the people who are so poor that even if they do save, they're not going to have enough to get by. So I think with those basic principles that we can come up with a solution to Social Security, which will help people out, keep the system manageable, and really have a smooth path for the future.
Yeah. Well, just I have a couple of callers. I'm going to get right to them, but just to ask a question about one of these things in particular. If we did some of the things that you both have talked about, if we raise the age at which you can receive a benefit, and if we take a look at people's resources, in a sense, do a kind of a means testing, you know, look at how much resources they have and then somehow scale the benefits accordingly. And then the one thing, the one thing that Mr. Bixby mentioned was that, you know, right now wages are taxed up to a certain point. And then if you make more than that, you don't pay any more into the system. Would you, I'm talking here to Andrew Biggs, can we take care of the problems that we've talked about by doing those other things and yet not that? I mean, can you really say by cutting back on benefits, by raising the retirement age, that we don't have to raise, we don't have to try to collect more money to be able to do that?
Well, certainly as a matter of mathematics, you can. It's easy to balance the system simply by raising the retirement age and reducing the growth of future benefits. Mm-hmm. You would just have to raise the retirement age a little bit more or reduce benefits a little bit more than if you had had the extra tax revenue. I think there's an argument to be made for increasing this cap on payroll taxes. Currently, you pay a 12.4% tax on earnings up to around $107,000, and that maximum increases each year, but some people have argued that because wages are less equal, there's greater inequality than there used to be, we should increase that cap. And I can understand that. It's not something I particularly favor, but it's certainly in the goals of getting to a deal on Social Security, it's certainly something that in a limited way at least I could acquiesce in. But I think trying to just eliminate the cap or rely entirely on revenues, It's a ton of money you'd have to raise through taxation, and you have to remember Medicare is still out there, and Medicare is going to be a tougher nut to crack. So Social Security is a program where it's very easy to substitute individual savings for Social Security benefits. If we all just saved a little more in our 401ks, we wouldn't need as much from Social Security. We wouldn't need to raise taxes so much. Medicare is a lot trickier to do. So I think if you have the excess tax revenues, that's where you want to think about targeting them.
Yeah. Well, and let me just real quick again, and I want to get to some calls. I want to ask Robert Bixby your thoughts about the kind of effort to get younger people more into managing their own kind of retirement savings. I think that there are some people, I'm not necessarily saying this is what Andrew Biggs is saying, but I think that there are some people who are saying, the end goal, though, there is some people would like to actually see us get rid of Social Security, or maybe it would be a much smaller, less important system, and that people would rely on their own savings and investing for their retirement. Do you think that Social Security is something that in the long run is viable, and you would like to see it continue essentially, you know, maybe with some small changes that we talked about, but essentially you would say, I'd like to see it continue essentially as it has been?
I think it is viable, and I think it's important to make the point for people like me, for example, that talk about the system being unsustainable in its current form. That's not to misstate or underestimate the importance that Social Security has played for the elderly in this country. It's really been very important in lifting the elderly out of poverty. So you don't want to, in reforming Social Security, undermine the important social achievements that it has made. So I don't think that the idea of ending Social Security or quote unquote privatizing Social Security, a term that's often misused, by the way, I think, is the way to go or has any political, really substantial political support for it. But I think that one of the political problems in trying to reform Social Security is that anytime anybody talks about change, defenders of the system who just tend to freeze up and think that you're out to destroy it. And it's you know, what the idea is to make the system sustainable over the long term, which it isn't now. For example, if you're in your 20s today, the system is not in shape to pay you the full benefits that it promises you. And I don't, you know, so for younger people, the system is is not viable as it is. It's not very comforting to them, I would think, to say, well, don't worry, the system will still be able to pay you, you know, three quarters of what it promises. That doesn't sound like a great deal. So I think that it is important to work on a way to make the promises sustainable. That way everybody has confidence that the system is going to be there for them, and it might help improve confidence that the young people don't have now that Social Security would be around for them. The only structural change I might think about making, and Andrew alluded to it earlier, would be some sort of account that would be added on to Social Security. I would do it as a new structure that would be added on to Social Security with a new mandatory savings account. But it would not, come out of the current system. So I would perhaps do that because that would help savings over the long term.
All right. We're a little bit past our midpoint here. We'll get to callers in a second. I want to introduce again our guest, Robert Bixby. He's joining us by phone. He's executive director of the Concord Coalition. It's a nonpartisan grassroots organization interested in fiscal responsibility. It's been around since 1992, was formed by two former U.S. senators, a Republican Warren Rudman and a Democrat Paul Tsongas. Here in the studio with me is Andrew Biggs. He's a resident scholar at the American Enterprise Institute, and he is here on the campus to take part in something called the Fiscal Wake-Up Tour. It's been going on now for a number of years. The folks at the Concord Coalition kind of taken a leadership position on this, but it has also involved people from different public policy organizations, the Heritage Foundation, the Brookings Institution, the American Enterprise Institute. The idea is they've put together panels of different people who have traveled around the country and to try to get people thinking about and talking about entitlements and what we deal with their rising, how we deal with their rising costs. There'll be one of these things happening today on the U of I campus at 4 o'clock in the Deloitte Auditorium in the Business Instructional Facility. It's sponsored by the Center for Business and Public Policy in the College of Business. And Andrew Biggs will be one of the panelists. Also, Diane Rogers, who is chief economist with the Concord Coalition, and David Certner, who is director of federal affairs with the AARP. We have a number of callers here, and they have been waiting patiently, so we want to get to them. People can also help us by being brief. We'll start out in Oswego and line four. Hello.
Yeah, good morning. I wish they would change the Social Security market, just at least, you know, modified it a little bit where, like you were bringing up earlier, putting some money aside. I do that now. I have IRAs. I don't rely on anybody or any one entity for paying my way through the rest of my life. I'm 52, and I'm looking at baby boomers retiring in mass droves or at least being axed by companies. The problem I have is it seems like everybody's going after big money. And I'm kind of disappointed in this because I know a lot of people who want to go after the people at the top that work for big companies. And then they whine about when their jobs are axed. And, you know, they're all complaining about all these corporate entities moving offshore, going to other countries, you know, IT people especially. I mean, I don't understand that. When you start telling people how to run their business, where do you think they're going to go? I mean, everybody's whining about that they're whining about taxes. Well, a good way to try and incorporate, make it so these companies can employ more people. I'm a small business, and I got to tell you, I had to lay off three of my people. It's just me now because of the amount of taxes I'm paying. I can't afford it. One, you know, liability insurance and all this other stuff, it's just insane. And they keep telling me they want me to put money back into my business so I can hire people and then turn around and tax me. It's kind of stupid, don't you think?
Well, I don't know what kind of response
we Well, I just say one of the things that you worry about with these deficits, when we look out over the future, this is one of the main points of the Fiscal Wake-Up Tour, and you see that we've talked a lot about Social Security. Actually, Medicare is a much bigger problem the further out you look. And the gap between, you know, we've tended to, if you'll pardon my using an economic phrase, but I mean, we tend to tax at about 18% of the economy, 18% of GDP, and we tend to spend about 21% of GDP. So this is over the past 40 years. So we've, on average, we run deficits of, you know, between 2-3% of GDP, which I think is too much for me, but it's not a catastrophic amount. what's going to happen as the baby boomers retire and start collecting Social Security and Medicare is that the gap between the revenues and spending is going to go way up, because that spending line of 21% of GDP is going to go to 22, 23, 24, 25, and if we continue to try to tax at 18% of GDP, the gap just becomes unsustainable because you're going to run big deficits that have to be serviced. Now, the other point is, so does that mean that we should let taxes go up to 20, 25, 26, 27% of GDP? And that's where you get to the caller's point, where you wouldn't be running deficits if you did that, but you would have some negative effect on the economy by running taxes at that level, which is why I think you really have to do a mix.
Well, one comment?
Yeah, I agree with Bob, what Bob said, and I think going back to the caller's point is it's important when we think about these programs, government programs, entitlement programs, we often think of them in the context of government financing. But it's important to remember where this money ultimately comes from. It comes from out of the economy, of people who produce things, are paid for things, and then pay taxes. So when we think about the reforms that we're going to put in place, we also want to think how these reforms will affect the health of the economy, because ultimately it's that economy that we rely on to finance these programs.
All right. Well, again, I want to thank the caller and go on here to someone in Marshall. This is line one. Hello.
Hello. Couple of things, I guess. I suspect that the job problem that the previous caller was talking about probably had as much to do with the downturn in the economy than the taxes that he's paying. I don't know what kind of taxes he's paying, but certainly the downturn in the economy would be more likely to be the problem he's facing there, although taxes, obviously, we don't like to pay him. The other thing is, during the campaign, Obama said that Social Security was actuarially sound until 2045 or 2047 or something like that. That's going to take care of a lot of the baby boomers by doing nothing. So it seems to me like we're howling about a problem that we, you know, yeah, we're kicking the can down the road, but, you know, 30 or 40 years down the road, I think we've got time to do that. I think we need to be looking at things like Medicare and Medicaid. Those are the real issues. I think we're worrying about things here that we've got bigger problems than Social Security. And I wish the people would be talking about that instead of about an imaginary – it's not a completely imaginary problem, obviously, but it's a less than a pressing problem. When we have Medicare and problems facing that, so I wish we would be talking about the real problem instead of about trying to scare people into thinking that Social Security is not going to be there, that we can't do anything about it if we don't do it right now, or have private accounts and that sort of thing. Those are scare tactics, and I just think they. That may be one reason why Bush didn't get very far with his program with privatization. So thank you very much.
All right. Well, I appreciate the comment. I think that maybe one reason I decided to start with Social Security is because it seems to be the thing where the issues are clearest and the solutions are clearest, and we've been talking about it for some time now. Let me pick up on one point, and I can get both. I'll start with Andrew Biggs and get Robert Bixby. Mm-hmm. Just real quick, there are some people who say there isn't, as far as Social Security is concerned, they say there isn't a problem. They say this is exaggerated. Growth in the economy, growth in productivity, you know, essentially, we don't have to worry about this.
There are people who deny you have a Social Security problem the same as you have people deny you have a global warming problem. So there's always going to be people who disagree. There is a great deal of uncertainty about the future. We can't predict what the economy will look like 50 years from now. But demographic forces we understand fairly well. We understand the growth of the labor force in the future because we know what the birth rate is today. Birth rates are much smaller or lower today than they were back in the 1950s or 1960s, and as a result, we'll have fewer new workers coming into the labor force. We also understand that life expectancies are rising, and when people are living longer, that means we're going to have more retirees. When you have more retirees collecting from a program and fewer workers paying into it, that produces a solvency problem. The caller was correct that Medicare and Medicaid together are a bigger problem than Social Security. They have all of the demographic problems of Social Security, plus a good case of inflation on top of that, in that healthcare prices are rising. But I will touch on one point he made. He said, you know, this is a problem that won't occur until the 2040s or something like that. These far off dates for Social Security are essentially a function of the discussion of the Social Security Trust Fund, that when the system begins running deficits, it can draw down the trust fund. But the thing to remember, though, the trust fund is not a store of gold sitting in Fort Knox somewhere. It is government bonds that have been written by one part of the government to another part of the government. So when Social Security has to start redeeming those bonds, which could be fairly soon because of the way the economy is going, that means the rest of the Treasury has to come up with the money, which means that we'll have to increase taxes, cut spending, do other things, run a larger deficit. Those steps don't take place in the 2040s when the trust fund runs out. They could take place within the next 10 years or so. As a matter of fact, the trust fund surplus, the Congressional Budget Office reported, has gone down to practically zero due to the recession. When that happens, that means that Social Security, instead of subsidizing the rest of the budget, is going to need to get subsidies from the budget. And that makes the rest of our budget deficits that much harder to address. So from a budget-wide perspective, from an economy-wide perspective, this isn't a far-off issue. It's something we need to deal with fairly soon.
And Mr. Bixby, anything you'd like to add?
No, I just reiterate that last point, that the problem is a lot more immediate than it appears because of the trust fund accounting. And, you know, it's just more important to look at the cash flows. It's not that the bonds in the trust fund are worthless IOUs, as you sometimes hear. That's not what either one of us are saying. The bonds will be honored, but the point is, at what cost? You have to look at the effect that Social Security's cash flows have on the budget, because if we have to go out in the markets to borrow that gap, or we have to raise other taxes or cut other spending in order to finance it, it has an effect. So you can't just look at the trust fund and say, gee, everything's fine until 2040. You have to look at both sides of the ledger and see. It might be fine if you're the Social Security Commissioner. But if you're the Treasury Secretary and you're trying to find the money to cover those bonds, it's a different problem.
All right. Let's talk with someone in Atwood, line two. Hello.
Hello. I'm a senior citizen on Medicare and Social Security. And Social Security wouldn't be in trouble if they hadn't taken $2.5 trillion out of the trust fund and put it in the general fund. Now, you've got your trust fund, but when it comes due, somebody's going to have to come up with that. So really, the government has stolen $2.5 trillion that is gone. And then let's go to Medicare. What my doctor charges me or charges Medicare is ridiculous. But what Medicare pays him is so ridiculous, I'm surprised he lets me in the door. And that's about all I got to say.
All right. Well, Mr. Bixby, you can take on either of those things.
The trust fund issue gets very very confusing. Actually, nothing has been stolen from the trust fund. The trust fund has gotten everything it's supposed to get, which is a government bond. So it is true that what is happening is that because of reforms that were enacted in the 1980s, the system has been running a large surplus, and so the government has been able to use the extra tax money to do other things, or borrow less from the financial markets. But the trust fund has gotten what it would get under any circumstances, which is an IOU from the rest from the Treasury, and it would get that whether we were running a budget deficit or a budget surplus. So, I mean, I agree to the extent that it's very questionable that we should have been having a tax rate that would bring in such a big surplus with no plan to use it for anything other than just paying routine bills. But as a practical matter, nothing's been stolen from the trust fund. It's got everything it's supposed to get.
We certainly, we're coming down to the point where we have maybe about 7 or 8 minutes. We certainly could have spent the entire hour talking about Medicare, Medicaid. Can you talk for a couple of minutes about that particularly, and what you think that we need to be thinking about there, Mr. Bixby?
Well, I think the problem with Medicare is rising health care costs. That, along with the demographics, but you've got both issues. With Social Security, it's basically a demographic problem. With Medicare, you've got the rising number of beneficiaries, plus you've got health care costs, which have tended to outpace the inflation rate. And so Medicare and Medicaid have been taking up a growing share of the budget, and just as health care costs have been taking up a greater share of the economy. And so what we really need to focus on there is finding some strategies to control health care costs generally. But there are ways that the federal government can take the lead, because Medicare and Medicaid make up such a big portion of health care expenses. So what Medicare does in terms of reimbursements, how it pays doctors, what it pays for, how it pays hospitals, what it reimburses for, we have to do a better job of reimbursing for quality rather than quantity. And I think that beneficiaries, upper-income beneficiaries, may expect to pay more for government benefits. In terms of means testing premiums, I don't mean paying more for individual services. Mm-hmm. So those are the kind of hard choices I think we're going to have to look at for Medicare.
I'll turn here to Andrew Biggs with me in the studio. Some people, I think, would have to say that this dealing with the Medicare Medicaid issue has to be part of a much larger look at health care in the United States, how it's delivered, what it costs. And I suppose ultimately there were people who would argue that, make the argument for national health, and that folding everything into the same system will help us deal overall with the cost of health care, and specifically also with Medicare, Medicaid.
Well, there's a common set of forces which are driving health care prices, both for private sector health care for working age people, and for health care provided by Medicare and Medicaid. There are essentially three things. The first is technologies providing new treatments today that didn't exist in the past. So one reason we spend more today is there's more things to spend it on, new treatments that we just couldn't have had in the past. A second issue is we have rising incomes. People are richer today than they were in the past. In a sense, you'd rather spend your dollar on an additional year of healthy life than use that extra dollar on buying another big screen TV or something like that. And the third issue is that the share of healthcare expenses paid out of pocket is a lot lower today than it was in the past. Back in the 1960s, over 50 cents of every healthcare dollar was paid out of pocket. That meant that the patient saw the cost. He was very concerned about getting a good value for his money. Today, only about 13 cents out of every healthcare dollar are paid out of pocket. The result of that is you have less incentive to really hunt for the best value. Now, there definitely is the argument that we need to address healthcare economy-wide, whether it's private sector or through government entitlement programs. I don't really agree with the argument, though, the only way we can fix Medicare's rising prices is by trying to fix prices within the working-age population. The thing to remember here is that the government spends almost 50 cents of every healthcare dollar nationwide. Medicare, Medicaid, VA, these are enormous programs. The government can have a great effect on pricing both within Medicare and Medicaid and in the private sector by changing its own practices. I would be very wary of essentially trying to take over healthcare for working age people when the government has had such a time controlling costs, even in which the programs in which it administers itself.
Yeah. All right. We'll try to get one more caller here, at least Urbana, line 3. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Yes. I think one thing that has not been considered at all in reference to Social Security is that we have a very large number of our workers in the millions who have paid into their private pension plans for decades in cases, and their companies have gone bankrupt or have been bought by companies that are less concerned with worker benefits and have gotten rid of the pension programs. This is part of what is an issue with the auto industry today. If the auto industry could go through bankruptcy and jettison the pension programs, the new owners of the auto companies would be much better off. The workers would be devastated. The result of this has been that for an ever-growing percentage of the workforce, Social Security becomes much more important than it has ever been in the past. Concurrently, it's been pointed out by one of your speakers that in the past, workers tended to work on longer, into their late 60s. Many workers would like to do that today, but if they perchance lose their jobs in their 50s, they can probably never get another good-paying job.
Yeah. Forgive me, we only have about 2 minutes, and I want to see if we can at least give our guys here a chance to respond to the points that you made.
Well, I made most of the points I wanted
okay.
to, so thank you.
Yes, and I appreciate your indulgence there. Let me go here. I think Andrew Biggs wanted to...
I'll touch
comment.
Quickly on the point he raised about private pensions. And it is important to consider that Social Security is a complement to private pensions and individual savings. But it's also important to remember that if a company goes out of business, those pensions are not lost. Private pensions are generally insured by what's called the Pension Benefit Guarantee Corporation. So if a company goes into bankruptcy or otherwise can't support its pension, the government takes over those pensions and for all but the highest paid workers will receive their full pension. So that you shouldn't take out of this the fear that if your company goes bankrupt, you're necessarily going to lose your pension. And in the case of 401ks, plans like that, you own them yourself, and so that's not subject to really the health of your company so much.
But that's just one more bill, one more tab for the government to pick up.
Oh, yes, it is. And those issues are important to consider as well. And so we want to think about strengthening retirement saving both on the individual level within private pensions and on the Social Security level. So we have many problems to solve.
Well, as we finish up here, Mr. Bixby, any last thought you'd like to leave with folks?
Well, you know, I think that it's really important that people not take all of this as gloom and doom. Maybe it comes across that way. I mean, I really think that we think of the Paul Revere as the symbol of the fiscal wake-up tour because it's really a way of spreading an alarm, and it's a way of preserving some of the programs like Social Security and Medicare that have been so successful in the past, and it's a matter of finding a way to make sure that they're successful for younger generations as they have been for the older generations, and that's going to require some change, and it just requires some hard-headed looks. But, you know, I look at what the government says to the auto industry and the banking industry. It says if you're going to expect us to bail you out, you have to have a viability plan. Well, the government needs a viability plan, too. And as soon as they finish out bailing out everybody else, they're going to have to look at their own books and realize that we don't have a viable fiscal policy right now, and we just have to make some tough choices and face them honestly.
We will have to leave it at there. Robert Bixby is the executive director of the Concord Coalition. Mr. Bixby, thank you.
You're welcome.
And here in the studio with me, Andrew Biggs. He's a resident scholar at the American Enterprise Institute. Glad you could be here.
Oh, it's been a pleasure. Thank you
very
much.
And I want to mention one more time that he's here to take part in a panel discussion that's part of this fiscal wake-up tour, along with Diane Rogers, who's chief economist of the Concord Coalition, and David Certner, director of federal affairs for AARP. That's today at 4 o'clock in the Deloitte Auditorium in the Business Instructional Facility on the U of I campus. It's sponsored by the Center for Business and Public Policy within the College of Business here at the University of Illinois, and it's open to anybody who would be interested in attending. One more thing we want to mention here, WILO programs are made possible with support from Lincoln Square in Urbana, a lifestyle center, which includes independently owned specialty shops, including Art Mart and Art Mart Toys. And that's it for us. Up next, though, it's the Afternoon Magazine. More coming up throughout the rest of the afternoon, and the host of the show, Celeste Quinn.
Thank you very much, David. Coming up today in the 1 o'clock hour of the Afternoon Magazine, our guest will be Philip Alcabes. He's an academic in the field of urban public health, and he has explored the history of epidemics, and he is the author of the new book, Dread, How Fear and Fantasy Have Fueled Epidemics from the Black Death to Avian flu. He'll join us following the 1 o'clock news. Let's take a look now at commodity prices in Kansas City. May wheat is trading at $5.69. That's down one. July, $5.79. Make that $5.78 and three quarters, down three quarters. Chicago May wheat, $5.25 and a half, up two and a quarter. July, $5.37, up two and a quarter. May corn, $3.93 and a quarter, up five and three quarters. July, $4.02 and a half, up five and a quarter. September, $4.12 and a quarter, up five and a quarter. December, $4.23 and a half, up four and a quarter. May beans, $10.35 and a half, up 14. July, $10.29 and three quarters, up 14. August, $10.05 and three quarters, up 14 and three quarters. September, $9.65 and a half, up 11 and a half. November, $9.35 and a quarter, up 8. May meal, $3.60.